It is Friday, August 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe expresses deep remorse on the 70th anniversary of Japan's surrender in World War II.
Prime Minister Abe acknowledged that Japan did impose untold suffering upon people in the region.
China searches for clues following this week's warehouse explosion in Tianjin, and we hear about a lawsuit between two rappers. It's all ahead. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe Friday expressed feelings of profound grief and sincere condolences to those who suffered and died from Japan's past military aggression. He made his highly anticipated public statement on the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. I spoke with VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul about Mr. Abe's speech. What were some of the main themes he brought up in this speech?
This is a statement that the Prime Minister delivers every 10 years on the anniversary of the end of World War II. This was a highly anticipated statement by the Prime Minister because there has been regional tension between Japan and China and South Korea over a perception that under Prime Minister Abe, Japan has been pulling back from past expressions of remorse. So in this statement, Prime Minister Abe acknowledged that Japan did impose untold suffering upon people in the region and took responsibility for Japan's role in starting the conflict, although Prime Minister Abe did mention that Western colonialism was one of the underlying causes of the war, but he said that Japan's decision to use force to try to resolve conflicts it had with the West rather than striving for peaceful reconciliation was misguided.
Did he mention Japan's neighboring countries, China and South Korea, in the speech?
He did mention China. He mentioned South Korea. He mentioned Southeast Asia, Pacific Islands, all about how these countries have suffered. But he was vague in the sense that China and South Korea in particular have been calling upon him in this statement to say very specific things, to say that the war was an act of aggression, to sincerely and explicitly apologize for the suffering that Japan caused upon the region. In South Korea in particular, President Park Geun-hye had called upon Prime Minister Abe to specifically address the issue of comfort women. These are the thousands, estimated to be 200,000 women across Asia who were forced to work as prostitutes for Japanese soldiers during the war. She had urged President Abe to address that issue and specifically atone for that atrocity and even offer some sort of compensation. He did not. He did not directly apologize. He did mention that Japan in the past has repeatedly apologized. He did offer sincere remorse, condolences, but he did not offer his own personal apology. He did not specifically talk about the comfort women, although he did talk about women who suffered and whose dignity and honor were severely injured. But there was a vagueness to it that will likely not satisfy many in the region here.
He made this speech as he is working, he and his government, to boost Japan's military program. Of course, this is coming as tensions have risen between China and other countries in the East and South China Seas.
Right. This is related. The two factors are related. Part of his refusal to directly apologize as as his predecessors have done in the past. And he said it in part of his statement, was saying that there are now generations in Japan who have no connection to this past war, and it's not fair to encumber them to constantly have to apologize. And that's a growing sentiment among some of his key nationalist supporters in Japan. And part of his program has been to kind of restore Japan's national pride. And so this was one element of it. And restoring its military, giving its military more latitude to proactively defend the interests of its countries by reinterpreting the Constitution and passing these new security measures is another part of that program.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Brian, for speaking with me today.
All right.
That's VOA correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul, South Korea. Well, looking at social media across Twitter, there were more than 9,000 mentions of Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in the past 24 hours, according to the analytics site Topsy. In the first hour after his speech, there were a lot of people tweeting negatively about Abe's apology, saying he stopped short. China's government press agency Xinhua News tweeted, "Japan's Abe offers no fresh apology for past aggression, colonial rule in World War II statement." Echoing the agency's statement, Japan Times, a Japanese English language newspaper, tweeted, "Abe's World War II declaration speaks of regret, but dodges details." Still, there are many experts now tweeting support for Abe's statements on the anniversary of Japan's World War II surrender. Tobias Harris is a Japan analyst at Tenio Intelligence. Using the Twitter handle @ObservingJapan, he tweeted, "In a formal sense, Abe has certainly checked the boxes he needed to." Other users are praising Abe for making a subtle reference to comfort women, taken and used by the Japanese during World War II. Anna Fitfield, the Tokyo bureau chief for the Washington Post, tweeted a photo of an English translation of Abe's speech, which read, "Japan will lead the world in making the 21st century an era in which women's rights are not infringed upon." Right now, the number of positive and negative tweets in response to Abe's speech are becoming more balanced. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of astronomers who studied more than 200,000 galaxies and precisely measured the energy produced within a large portion of the cosmos have confirmed that the universe is slowly dying. Their measurements indicated that the universe is generating only about half as much energy as it did 2 billion years ago. Using many of the world's most powerful ground-based telescopes and 3 space telescopes, the astronomers said that their research has produced the most complete assessment of the energy output of the nearby universe. Scientists have known that the energy of the universe is slowly fading away since the late 1990s, but this study provides new details that it's taking place across all wavelengths in the electromagnetic spectrum, from ultraviolet to the far infrared. The astronomers would like to continue their research so that they can map the production of energy over the entire history of the universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll look at a legal case between two rappers. Chinese authorities are continuing an investigation into what caused 2 gigantic explosions at a warehouse in Tianjin, as fears linger over the possible presence of dangerous chemicals near the site. I spoke with VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide, who just returned from spending the day in the port city. To begin with, Bill, I believe officials held a news conference today to discuss about the investigation that is underway into these explosions in Tianjin.
Yes, that's right. This was our second press conference so far, updating on what's going on and addressing what is really a key concern for many residents in Tianjin and elsewhere, even as far away as Beijing, about the chemicals that were stored in the warehouse. At that press conference, they talked about how firefighters are clearing the way to try to get into the area. where the fire is still blazing. They're bringing in sand to help with chemicals, trying to put the chemicals out. But the blaze is still going. The other interesting detail that came up, there was a safety watchdog official who talked about the company in question here at the center of this disaster and how in 2012 they refurbished their warehouse and turned it into a facility that could house hazardous materials. He says that any given time, it could have about 50,000 tons of all types of hazardous materials. And he also stressed that it was a warehouse where chemicals and these dangerous hazardous materials come but then are transferred to other places, so they don't stay there very long. Hence, it makes it very difficult to get a handle on just what was in the warehouse at the time. He also highlighted the fact that in questioning of the managers of the company, they have discovered there's discrepancies in what the managers of the companies of the company Lehigh International are telling them about just what kind of materials were there at the time this disaster occurred.
Bill, I believe you've been today talking with people in Tianjin about how they are coping and some of their concerns following these explosions.
Yes, I spent most of the day in the Tianjin Development Zone, which is right next to the industrial area where this warehouse was. It's only about 4 kilometers away. And the key concern is really what's in the air and what kind of chemicals could be impacting and affecting people's health. The government says that it is safe and that the wind is blowing in the right direction. It's blowing off the smoke offshore, so it's not actually blowing back into the city. But there are many people who are questioning that. On the street, I saw a large amount of people wearing face masks. It seemed quite different. Even when it's very polluted here, not a lot of people wear face masks. But the number that I saw today on the streets was really quite different than anything I've seen before. Also, I had a chance to talk with people about what they felt, what their impressions are of what happened with the blast. And in addition to talking about safety issues, one student that I spoke with talked about how she felt it was a city planning issue, and she was concerned about how it was that this warehouse was right next to or not far away from residential complexes.
And of course, Tianjin is a really big port, so near Beijing, near the capital. Do you know, has business been impacted? I mean, just because of the port, all things coming through there.
Well, we're hearing Reuters has been following up on this. They watch those kind of things very closely, and the imports and exports have been impacted. When I spoke to people in Tianjin, they were telling me that the number of trucks that we were seeing on the street was actually about 60% of what it usually is. It was a lot less than what you typically see. And that's what I saw on the streets as well, too, that there really were not that many people out. And so I asked several different people, and they all said the same thing. It's like, this is not normal. This is very unusual. And so many people were staying inside because of their fears and their concerns about what's in the air.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Bill, for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.
That's VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide, and this is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Now a little something from the world of music, where rappers Jay-Z and Timbaland will be in court next month in a 16-year-old lawsuit over their mega hit, Big Pimpin'. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Soul Lounge host, Shauna Renee, about the lawsuit, which has the rappers embroiled in a morass involving Egyptian law, song rights, movie soundtracks, and millions of dollars.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Jay-Z and Timbaland were in the studio, and Timbaland grabbed a CD that contained a Middle Eastern-inspired riff, or just a tune that he believed to be public domain, which meant that it was available to use without any condition, any payment whatsoever. So it turns out, however, that that song was from a 1960s Egyptian film called Fateh Ahlami. And that, in fact, the song did need to be paid for. EMI, who is responsible for rights and all these kinds of things, said that they indeed had to pay for use of this portion of the song. So Timbaland and Jay-Z and the record company paid $100,000 for the use of this very short version or piece of the song, and thought that at this point, all was well. This happens all the time, especially in hip hop. We sample music, bits of music, you pay for it, you keep it moving. Well, it turns out that the family members of the original composer, Bahli Hamdi, said that they, in fact, are owed more money because EMI did not have a right to allow Timbaland and Jay-Z to use this sample in what we have to say is probably one of Jay-Z's biggest songs.
Pimp C, Jigga Man. You know I thug them, hug them, love them, leave them, but I don't trust or need them. Take them out the hood, keep them looking good, with diamond cuffs that'll freeze them. First time they fuss, I'm breezing. Talk about what's the reasons. I'm a pimpin' every sense in the word, why my better trust and believe them. In the cup where I keep them, till I need the word, till I need to beat it up, then it's BB, then I'm picking them up, then I play with it quick in the truck.
There's no denying that they used this portion of the song.
Right.
They admitted they paid for it. Now, the question is how much was made from it and whether or not the family has a right to say or can say legally, we did not give EMI permission to allow Timbaland and Jay-Z to use. And Timbaland and Jay-Z will be testifying in this case. So this is going to be something that we'll be talking about for a while.
Oh, boy, the drama continues. Well, if you have any comments on this, you can send a tweet to Shauna. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also send one to at VOA underscore music. You can send one to us at VOA underscore IE. And, of course, you can catch Shauna in the Soul Lounge. Log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
Sorry, oh. Come straight about the black barrio. Make some meal about for sorry. What? Now sit back and beat my scenario. Oops, my bad, that's my scenario. No, I can't fucking scare it. What? Now every time, every place, everywhere we go. Fuck that point and say, there he go. Now he's bumping. No, we carry more heat than a little bit. We don't pull it out over little shit. And if you catch a lick when I spit, then it won't be a little hit. Go read a book, you illiterate son of a bitch. Step up your vocab. Don't be surprised if your damn out with me and you see it's coming down on your slam.
Smoking eye, going up, keep it lean up.
Some rap sounds there, and that's our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. We have a range of stories that might interest you. You can look for more details about Japan as well as the continuing investigation into the explosion in China. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 21, 2013, Syrian government forces committed a heinous atrocity. They attacked the civilian population of the Damascus suburb of Ghouta with sarin gas, a chemical weapon that affects the nervous system. Over 1,000 Syrians, including hundreds of young children, died and thousands more were injured. The act was immediately and universally condemned and prompted the threat of U.S. military strikes. Consequently, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was brought to the negotiating table. The Kerry Lavrov framework, along with increased international pressure, induced Syria to join the Chemical Weapons Convention and relinquish its declared stockpiles of chemical weapons. These were then shipped out of Syria and destroyed. However, nobody was held accountable for the terrible deaths of thousands of Syrians on August 21, 2013. Attacks against Syrian civilians have continued, now using mostly chlorine gas delivered in barrel bombs dropped out of helicopters. On August 7th, nearly 2 years after the Ghouta attack, the United Nations Security Council unanimously adopted Resolution 2235. It establishes a joint investigation mechanism to identify in the Syrian Arab Republic individuals, entities, groups, or governments who were perpetrators, organizers, sponsors, or otherwise involved in the use of chemicals as weapons, including chlorine or any other toxic chemical. This mechanism would come into play once the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons fact-finding mission determines that a specific incident in Syria involved or likely involved the use of chemicals as weapons. The goal is to create a shared international factual basis for eventual accountability. Until we adopted today's resolution, there was no mechanism to take the obvious next step, determining who was involved in such attacks. Even when there were obvious signs pointing to the parties responsible, investigators were not empowered to point the finger. This has compounded an already rampant sense of impunity in Syria, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power. To those who think that impunity will last forever for the perpetrators and all others involved in chemical weapons attacks, those who order chemical attacks, those who fill munitions with chemicals, those who drop chemical weapons, look at all of the perpetrators today who find themselves being forced to answer for acts committed years or even decades ago, she said. The evidence gathered by the joint investigative mechanism will stand as a record not just of what has been done, but of who has done it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.